Welcome to the Athenaeum Review podcast. I'm Ben Lima, and today we're honored to welcome Dr. Ian McGilchrist, a psychiatrist, neuroscience researcher, philosopher, and literary scholar, and the author of, without exaggeration, two of the most important books of the 21st century. First, The Master and His Emissary, The Divided Brain and the Making of the Western World, and second, The Matter with Things, Our Brains, Our Delusions, and the Unmaking of the World. He said, quote, "Our talent for division, for seeing the parts, is of staggering importance, second only to our capacity to transcend it in order to see the whole," end quote. And I will say personally that having been trained myself in academic art history, these books help me to understand why so much academic writing on art history seems so inadequate to its object and what it means to truly encounter a work of art and truly understand it. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much indeed.
And this morning, he'll be speaking with Dr. Julia Friedman, an art historian, writer, and curator who's published widely on numerous subjects in modern and contemporary art. Thank you, Dr. Friedman.
Thank you very much, Ben. And Dr. McGilchrist, it's an honor to speak with you and to ask you some questions that I have been mulling over for, the last 3 years, probably. I'm a latecomer to work. I did not read The Master and His Emissary when it came out, and only got to read it when you began advertising The Matter with Things. So the very first lecture that I heard by you was the one that you gave in Paris. And kept rewinding it and kind of going back and listening and thinking as you spoke before you got to the end, how applicable it is to all the situations and problems that art historians find themselves in. And as we got to the end of that lecture, as you got to the end, you began to speak about art, and you brought up, I recall, postmodernist art. I think you said contemporary art at the time, but you said a few things that were just stunningly accurate. And although it was a brief, very brief segment, it pretty much nailed the problem. So what's wrong with postmodernist visual art?
That's very interesting to hear that from you, yes. Tell me what struck you as right.
The thing that you said, the thing that was particularly striking for me, is that you said that the works of art have to have this creed next to them in order to communicate with the viewer. And this is absolutely right. And then, of course, the reason I kept kind of obsessively thinking throughout your talk, and the talk was a sort of a general talk about the left and the right hemisphere modality, and you spoke a lot about bureaucracy. And one of the banes of art history and art criticism right now is the ballooning of art bureaucracy, which self-justifies by creating those creeds.
Oh, yes. That's interesting. How does that impinge on you? Do you mean that? I'm not sure in what way bureaucracy is impinging on you as an art historian. I can think of ways in which it might.
Okay, well, so it impinges on us hugely because art history essentially began, of course, as a field that was a branch of aesthetics, and an object was at the very base of art history. And at some point, and that didn't happen exactly in 1979, but at some point the object took a backseat to the theory of the object, and the critic began to become an indispensable part of interpreting a work, and this sort of mediumistic function of the critic, which Under good circumstances, you know, the critic can elucidate the meaning of the work. It just became, the critic became a central figure in the sense. And then artists were raised essentially to think that they need this structure to make art. So I don't know, because it's chicken and egg. I don't know what happened first exactly, but there are now generations of artists that are inducted into thinking that they have to have an explanation. And so the explanation then drives the work, which is reflected on the status of the object. And the object becomes less important and the text becomes more important. And of course, it drives this whole linguistic mode of postmodernist art. And so it's at this point, it's a self-perpetuating mechanism. But what you said in the talk and what struck me so much is now you go to a museum and there's this big text next to the work.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And that didn't used to be the case. So
No, that's right. I mean, one way of looking at it is, it's an ugly phrase, but to say that metaprocess has taken over from the process. So we're no longer sort of engaging directly, but we're engaging with somebody's theory about what we should be engaging. And one of the differences I would suggest between the way in which the two hemispheres work is that the right hemisphere is engaged in a more direct and embodied way with reality, with experience, which is not to say that it's in any sense cruder or more basic, just because it's more immediately connected with experience. It's in fact, as I lay out in the Matter-y things, more intelligent, more perceptive, and more attentive, and indeed more in touch with reality than the left hemisphere. The left hemisphere on its own actually becomes deluded because it's so separate from immediate experience that it creates a fantasy about an explanation that's completely irrational, improbable, and starts to believe it. So we live now in a world in which, as it were, the map, the left hemisphere's abstract schema, has taken over from the world that is mapped. And I think this begins with modernism. And I mean, I quote Virginia Woolf saying something like the modern world began in 1910 or something like that. I think she says in the autumn of 1910. But I mean, the point she's making is that there came about a huge self-consciousness about what we were doing, which got in the way of actually doing it.
Well, let me stay a little bit with postmodernism, because I would like to put forth to you that modernism, while definitely there is a continuity between modernism and postmodernism with the self-conscious tendency, modernism is not all that bad, whereas postmodernism is so, as you describe it, left hemisphere dominant that there's really no salvation for it. When you talk about postmodernism, and actually, so here I go back to the master and his emissary, because there's an extensive section towards the end of the book about art, and you point out some traits of postmodernism, for example, reductionism, that makes people feel powerful, you say. Why is it important? Why is it a goal to feel powerful?
I'm not sure that I may have done. I can't prove I haven't, but the point I was getting at is that it's something that I was aware of in my work as a scholar of literature in my early 20s, was there was a tendency for the critic to be superior to the author. that somehow the author in his simplicity sort of thought that he was doing this, that or the other. But the critic, being much more somehow intelligent and Olympian, was able to look down on that writer and point out what it was the writer didn't see or didn't know. And I thought this was a very bad way to progress towards an understanding of art. This, in fact, this typically arrogant and hubristic manner is, again, rather typical of what I see. I mean, I haven't explained because we haven't gone there yet, but I mean, what I'm suggesting is that in the modern era, and in particular in the last 150 years, but probably since the time of the Enlightenment, there has been a shift more and more towards the dominance of the left hemisphere, which is literal-minded and tends towards abstraction, tends, as I say, towards theory, to decontextualizing, to rendering what should be working implicitly explicit, and in manipulation. So from a purely evolutionary point of view, the left hemisphere is designed simply to help us get stuff, to grab something and get it, to eat it, to use it for some purpose. I mean, that is effectively, it's so important that it effectively is the purpose of the left hemisphere. And that has nothing to do with intelligence, imagination, intuition, insight into what's going on. It's just about acquisition. And the right hemisphere, meanwhile, is left sort of with all the rest, understanding that almost everything is can't be pinned down in this way, that it is rich, that it is embodied, that it takes into account moral and emotional information, as well as purely intellectual information, although it's better at that, the intellectual side, than the left hemisphere too. I mean, they both need to contribute. I'm not saying the left hemisphere doesn't contribute, but I'm just trying to correct a misperception that somehow the right hemisphere is too emotional to be thinking straight. On the contrary, it is the hemisphere that helps us to think more clearly, to question our assumptions. Ramachandran, a distinguished neuroscientist, calls it the devil's advocate, because where the left hemisphere is jumping in and saying, I see clearly what it is, as an example of that, putting it into a category, the right hemisphere is going, no, hang on, it could be something else, it's more different, it could be something different, and it's more subtle than that. So all of this, I think, has begun to affect us. And of course, it's not about judgments about what's good and what's bad, because in a way, you can never keep a good artist down. However bad and however unpropitious the intellectual and cultural climate may be, there will always be artists whose genius will transcend it. But I do think that the last 100 years or so has been a period during which it's become harder, because we overemphasize the explicit, the theoretical, at the expense of things that should really speak to us on a level that is so deep and moving that we can't immediately articulate it. So that's really what I'm getting at. And I agree with you that there is no huge distinction, or there is a distinction, but it's not there is a continuity between modernism and postmodernism, but there's something special about postmodernism that I agree with. But what is striking is that I show that, without anybody knowing this, what a lot of the art and thought of the 20th century exhibited was something like the way of thinking, the way of experiencing, the way of seeing of somebody who has literally had damage to the right hemisphere. When people, when patients have a stroke, a tumor, or whatever, they start to see these very bizarre things that the 20th century art world has tried to incorporate into its work. So to me, that was fascinating. And I think that, the way in which postmodernism takes us into a world in which nothing can really be said to be real, it's all, as it were, whatever we choose to make it. This is the typical fantasy of the left hemisphere, that it can make things any way it wants. And we see this in our culture all around us. We're obsessed with being able to do anything and rewrite history and rewrite nature in any way we want, because we are all powerful. in the process, I think we're destroying ourselves, but that's another matter.
And that probably has to do with control, which is one, as you also, and that probably, does it have to do with control?
Absolutely.
Because if you neutralize the power of art, then you thus become yourself more important.
I guess I could be right. Yes, yes. I mean, the exaltation of the self. See that whatever else, what I say is my truth, and you can't argue with it. It's really the end of a culture which involves people sharing beliefs and values. And if you want to be the narcissist who everything they say and think and experience is true because it's theirs, frankly, good luck to you. But you're not a member of a society, and we can pretty much ignore you for now. I mean, the difficulty is that more and more people are taking this path.
So Dave Hickey, who spoke of himself as the analyst of Western culture, after realizing that post-structuralism as a critique of power was essentially something that would not allow one to keep his integrity and stay within the structure of power. And he also, and it's kind of another parallel, he realized that there is certain fatuousness in teaching meanings of literature, because it, again, it kind of dismantles, deconstructs literature and kills it. And the only occupation in which you could do it would be if you do it for a grade, if you get paid for it. And so he left. And then after that, he wrote songs. He wrote for the Rolling Stone. He wrote music criticism. And eventually, after opening an art gallery, he began to write about art. His most important, kind of probably the best known books are The Invisible Dragon, Four Essays on Beauty, where he argues against what he calls the new Puritans from the progressive left, and the new Puritans who prioritize virtue over beauty, and letting the institutions disturb a very delicate ecosystem of art. He laments the surrender of the beautiful objects to virtue that is promoted by the therapeutic institution. When Hickey speaks about the therapeutic institution, he speaks about the utopian bureaucrats whose only utopian attribute is the visceral contempt for both relevant past and physical presence, while they're winning the culture war, which results in what he calls a cultural demolition derby. Because, as he put it, the past is presumed to be lost, and there is nothing more than it's nothing more than a cautionary narrative against which the present must be inculcated.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know him or his work, but I mean, my immediate thought is that one of the, I think, erosive forces of the last 100 years has been the way in which all dialectic is in terms of power. So in a society which, compared with previous societies, has been remarkably egalitarian, most of the things that we talk about are in terms of who has power and who's oppressing who. I mean, this is sort of sub-Marxism, basically, and it's carried on in different forms, with all kinds of bodies having grievances because they feel that power is being wielded over them by somebody else. But this is the only way in which the left hemisphere can conceive things, is in terms of power, because that is its raison d'etre. Its only value is power. But the values of things like beauty, which art is more concerned with, are much better understood by the right hemisphere. And so this discourse of power sort of leads to some of the more ridiculous things that have happened recently, where, you know, massively important works of art, because they belong to the Western tradition, have, you know, had a Black and Decker drill taken to them effectively. So on. So I think the culture of excitement about you know, not being in the power structure and all that. I think it's game playing for people who want to think of themselves well, but I think they're doing that at the expense of the real greatness of art, in which we should set these things aside. I mean, art shouldn't be for doing things. It's been conceived, as, for example, it was in the Soviet state, as for promoting a certain vision of humanity, and which is a utilitarian one. As I say, you know, Piero della Francesca didn't need to put a script next to any of his paintings or frescoes to explain what they were. I mean, Bach didn't need to announce before he played a piece of music what it meant, as now modern composers have to do. So this movement towards the explicit, towards the concept of everything being in terms of power, rather than, frankly, one's more humble surrender in front of something that inspires wonder and awe, that is what art is to me. I know I've loved art all my life, and I mean by art poetry, painting, architecture, and perhaps above all, music. And these things in me inspire wonder that makes life worth living. They are, if I start vaunting myself, or the critic starts vaunting him or herself at the expense of the artist, something has been lost. And so I did an almost inverse thing, which was I wrote a book called Against Criticism, which for somebody who'd got an Oxford fellowship in literary studies was like shooting yourself in the foot. But I realized that the process was itself erosive, that what we were doing was taking a work of art that was individual, implicit, and unique, and turning it into something general in nature, abstract, and thoroughly banal once it had been decoded. This idea of decoding, you see, is another of these left hemisphere ideas that really, it doesn't understand what a work of art is, so it starts applying a kind of analytic mind to it, and once it's done that bit of analysis, think, I've understood it. Actually, it's probably taken you away from understanding. I don't want to be too rigid about this, because I do think there's a place, very much so, for analytic work, and that's why, Ben, you started by quoting my words about art, the staggeringly important talent we have for taking things apart. But the bit we seem to forget is putting them together to make a coherent whole again. And you know, it's like approaching a piece of music. At first you love it and you want to play it. And as you try to play it, you realize you have to take it apart and practice little passages over and over again and all that kind of thing. And you learn about the harmonic development of the piece and its structure. But when you go out on stage and play it, you must forget all of that and reintegrate that information, which wasn't wasted, was went to enrich the performance. If we thought more in those terms, you know, art criticism, like literary criticism, is a valuable tool if it's done well and not done in the interests of vaunting the critic at the expense of the work of art. But when that information has been received and digested, one then needs to return to a more holistic appreciation of what it is. And the idea that it can be translated into something else always gets between you and the immediate connection with the whole. And it's that connection in which the work of art, whatever it may be, comes alive, as far as I'm concerned. It's an encounter. And in that encounter, we have to give of ourselves to meet it. And it needs to sort of have something to hook us as well. And making all that too explicit, and certainly turning it into a power struggle between the critic and the artwork, is going to be damaging.
Indeed. And I think actually, Dave Hickey would agree, because first of all, when he used to refer to a cultural demolition derby in okay. terms of what is going on. That's and he was known as he joked about it. He was known as a beauty guy because his proposition was that beauty, that great art is undeniable. And
I should know more about him. Sorry, I'm so ignorant.
I'm a very, very poor translator. So one of the things he said actually is that what happens with great art is even when you think that you don't want to like it, you physically, it makes you dance. You physically like it. Because it has this ineffable, essentially, quality of beauty. And one of his big overarching arguments was that is ultimately what democracy is, because people get together in groups through liking, through commuting with the works of art that are undeniable, and that cannot be legislated by the therapeutic institutions, but it comes from individuals commuting with the works of art in the way that those works are unique and undeniable. So that was his line. The other thing, actually, I want to mention to you, he had this, he wrote a book at some point, which was called Pirates and Farmers. And that's actually as close as it came to the left-right hemisphere argument. He says that all humanity is divided into pirates and farmers. Farmers build defenses. Pirates destroy them. Some pirates know that they need farmers, but all farmers hate pirates.
Sounds very interesting guy. Yes, I've got something there to discover. Yeah, and I'm glad he spoke up for beauty, because you know one of the things that I've noticed is that no artist now wants their work to be praised for being beautiful. They want it to be praised for being powerful, which is the value set of the left hemisphere. It's all about power, not about beauty. And you will know, and you may even be able to tell me what it is in Russian, that Dostoevsky famously said that the world will be saved by beauty. And for a long time, I wondered what he meant by that, because beauty is an ambiguous thing. Sometimes things can be beautiful without being necessarily good. But I think that what he was saying is exactly something you touched on when you were reporting on William Hickey. Is that we can argue ourselves into places where we believe that things that are not good are good. We can believe that things that are not true are true. But the beautiful actually speaks directly to us in a way that is, you know, immediately compelling. And I think that's probably what he was getting at, that in a world that has lost its rudder or its compass or whatever you like to call that. In such a world, beauty is the lodestar.
Absolutely. No, this is definitely this is something that one feels also as one goes through art historical narratives as a student, even. You know, what also struck me as I began to listen to your lectures and read your work is somehow, so over the years of studying and teaching art history, I developed my own likes and dislikes and preferences. And I could never actually quite justify it, except for it was always individual artists. For example, I have this really kind of almost strong dislike of Kandinsky. And I really, really like Malevich. And so once I read your work, I realized that the reason for this is actually that Kandinsky is ultimately represents, he's an imposter. He represents the left hemisphere behavior, which masks itself as the right hemisphere, because he's really trying to, he talks about the intuitive,
but he's anything but intuitive. He was trained as an attorney. He was a law professor, and he forever stayed a law professor. He can do an absolutely beautiful job retrieving the explanations of how his paintings work. And in fact, there's this one really funny letter that he wrote, I mean, funny to me, in 1913, when a rich American collector bought his painting, The Canons. And he writes this explanation, and he says, well, you shouldn't take it literally. Yes, there is a talk of war in Europe, but, you know, it's just a departure point. And then he goes on to say, as I was painting this painting, I was getting instructions as if, but the corners must be heavy. And this elaborate dance that he gives for this supposedly mediumistic performance, and of course he claimed to have had synesthetic abilities, but if you look at his work, you could see that he's always kind of two steps behind somebody less prominent. But then he can repackage it, adapt it, and sell it in a really convincing way. Malevich, yes. On the other hand, and this is where I would argue with you a little bit. Yes. When you mentioned Malevich in The Master and His Emissary,
I do.
yeah. So you said that what he did was a statement.
Yes.
And it was a statement, but. Malevich, actually, he was a poet. He was really a poet. He had poetic imagination. And one of the things he said when he talked about the Black Square, he said, the Black Square is a living, regal infant. So he actually spoke of his forms as living forms. And he did insist on that color is the most important thing for the painter. So he didn't just do the black and white first. He did other colors as well. The paintings got more complicated as time went on, but he really, his ambition was not to simplify, but his kind of, he came from the place where as a believer, as a Russian Orthodox, he believed that, well, God created everything. And so if the artist repeats God's creation, that would necessarily lack originality. And so if you're going to make original art, imitation is not originality. And so his style suprematism, he called it the new painterly realism, in that it's creation of new forms. But the black square is the living, regal infant, not like a dead square. It's okay. A sort of new.
I remain unconvinced by his giving it that name. I'm talking about the work. You can call it what you like, but then we're in the realm, aren't we, of something else, the words about it. And it seems to me that it's an example of novelty as opposed to true newness. I make a distinction between things that are seeking to make the impression that they're new and things that are not seeking any impression but are profoundly new. It's the difference between fantasy and imagination, where fantasy takes us away from reality, but imagination helps us for the first time to enter into reality. And so I that's what I see going on there. But we don't have to argue about Malevich. He just seemed to me an example of what was happening in this world where an idea was more important and a new idea was more important than I mean, the whole emphasis on originality is a slightly crazy one, isn't it? Because once you seek originality, then it becomes a second order thing. It's a conscious move to be different. I think a lot of the trouble started when people rejected the idea that they should truly learn from people who were great painters, which is how the highly original painters, the Renaissance, became the original painters they were. They were massively original. They're highly individual. But they didn't do it by not learning from their masters. They painstakingly learnt techniques. And I'm afraid we're now in a world where people want a quick fix. And learning a technique like that takes years and years and years of study. And at the end of it, you don't just reproduce, unless you're an icon painter, as you know, an icon painter should reproduce exactly the way an icon is painted. But for a painter, it's just, as it were, learning the grammar that will enable you to speak your own great message.
Well, I think actually that's exactly what Malevich did, and he was academically academically trained. He could he could paint in the mimetic way, and also I was going to ask you actually, have you seen his paintings in person?
I think I did see one in London at an exhibition. But that's it.
Yeah, I believe Courteau has one work at least. So they, in person, they appear completely different, completely different from this sort of graphic just illustration. Mm. And so I would argue that actually they do come alive as you look at the embodied paintings. And they're completely not alive if they're seen in reproduction.
Reproduction. Well, that's a very good point. And also, I want to make clear, because people may easily misunderstand me, that I'm not saying something so simple as that, you know, art just needs to be representational. That's not what I'm saying at all. I suppose we've spent a lot of time talking about the modern situation. As you know, the second half of The Master and His Emissary is a kind of attempt to review the shifts in thought at the major turning points in the history of the West. So the Greek civilization, the Roman civilization, and what happened in those, and then the West really from the Renaissance onwards. And in all those cases, I can see a sort of a shift from something that is wonderfully alive and expressive towards something that is, and not necessarily in a straightforward representational way yet again, but that eventually becomes stereotypical, fossilized, hierarchical, and no longer, to me anyway, great art. At a time when the civilization was failing, basically.
Right. And that's part of the Whitehead argument that you cite. Mm-hmm. And there's definitely the cyclicity, and there's definitely the tendency to academize whatever life thing happens. And that's the left hemisphere taking over after a while. And this argument is completely, it's impeccable. It's if you look at the development of art history, it's completely correct. But can I run something by you? So I was thinking that you're actually the right-left hemisphere modality can explain the course of modern art. So if we start with Edouard Manet, so you the Renaissance as the sort of the apex of art history, and then it becomes eventually it becomes academized, and so by the beginning of the 19th century, there's a really interesting situation where you have the academy, which completely wants to erase the presence of the artist in the painting by eliminating the brushstroke completely and giving you all sorts of formulas for color and drawing and composition and everything, and even the subject matter. So you could, and there's a very strict hierarchy of genres and all that. And then, so one could see Manet coming out against it, by trying to go back to the unique nature of painting, where painting is not something that follows rules or replication of reality, but it is something alive. And in order to make it alive, it has to begin to manifest itself in the way only painting can, but real life cannot. So it's no longer illusionistic. And again, it's a painter who can paint just fine. So the reason he goes flat is not because he cannot build his perspective properly, but for a reason. And then from there, one could see the rest of sort of modernist development, and that would be even, you know, new impressionism, so pointillism, as a series of attempts to locate those visual strategies and links that allow people to commute with the artwork directly. So in divisionism, pointillism, the viewer is supposed to coagulate the painting. And then there are movements such as fauvism, which makes the color arbitrary from the point of view of the painter and from the point of view of the viewer. And so many of the modernist movements, they're essentially kind of right hemisphere modality movements, which try to re-eliven the painting. But then there are other movements such as futurism, probably most prominently, and constructivism, that want to kill the humane in painting and extinguish it completely. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's very interesting. And I quote this in a nihilistic delight and destruction that went on in those movements as part of the war on life, really. The thing is, art movements are never simple because people are massively, thank God, complex beings. And so one can easily get into the problem of sounding as if one's sort of making very broad and general statements and don't cover the individual cases. What I wanted to do in discussing in the book, in discussing modernism, was to emphasize the ways in which, despite everything, there were great artists. There always will be great artists, as I say, in every age, one hopes. But that some of the tendencies were alarmingly about dismantling, destroying, annihilating. And on the whole, I don't think that creativity is best served by these tendencies. Once again, you seem, not you personally, but the artist seems or feels himself, or it was usually himself, to be powerful and original and somehow able to shock by destroying, but to shock by inverting and so on. This is slightly childish. This is the kind of thing that teenagers do, and on the whole, you hope they come through that and develop a deeper, more mature understanding of what they're dealing with. And that's my worry about it, is it seems a bit facile, a lot of it. But there still were great painters who were doing something very important. Don't get me wrong. And there are many movements in modernism as well. You can't sort of lump them all into one.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And there are some really interesting cases with Dada, for example, Dada in Zurich. One can make an argument that this is profoundly humanistic, actually, movement, because initially what they were doing rose from their disgust with this civilization that caused the slaughter of the war. And so their denial of art as we know it was the extension of their denial of civilization that caused this inhumane destruction. And so while, yes, in the sense they're dismantling the old art, they're actually doing it in protest against something that is inhumane.
I do understand that, but I believe that if you dislike a civilization, you don't try to destroy it, you try to improve it. Civilizations take a long time. We don't have control over making a new civilization, but what we can do is we can lead it towards higher values. I think that's indeed one of the purposes of life, actually, is to do our bit to try and promote the better values that where we can see them and where we are lucky enough, if we are creative, to be able to offer them to people. So I think that healing, I mean, it is not never a process of destruction. I mean, I'm a doctor, so I have spent, I'm now retired, but a lot of time obviously meeting and trying to help people where things had gone wrong. I didn't do it by killing them. I did it by trying to restore them to health. And I think that's the way we should be thinking about our society and a civilization. It's easy to destroy. It's so difficult to create. You know, in 5 seconds, some lunatic with a hammer destroyed Michelangelo's Pietà, and it took him I don't know how many years to make it. Destroying is quick and easy. You throw tomato soup over a painting, but actually producing it is somebody's life was sweated to make it. And that's so wonderful that people made those sacrifices. And we should approach the whole business, in my view, in a spirit of greater respect, really. And that means the artists have to respect art as well as are being told to respect art.
That is actually a really, really interesting point. And you do have unique perspective on that, on applying the hypocritical oath to the treatment of art and culture. That is, yeah. And of course, this is not the rule. If only that was the rule that was applied, we would have avoided a whole swath of movements that were dehumanizing and destructing, essentially. Constructivism probably being the most obscene example, although one could also say that all of the, the social realism and socialist realism, even though they're in the guise of human form, right, and yeah, empathy in painting. This is absolutely true.
One of the interesting things is that, you know, when people are doing harm, they never present it as harm. They always present it as doing good. Anyway, carry on, well, please.
Yeah, no. That's your therapeutic institution that believes that they're pursuing virtue. And yeah. Lately, a lot of the destruction and a lot of the harm has been done under the pretext of helping and saving and readjusting. And ideas like equity applied to art is completely counterintuitive, because it is an individual sport and there has to be recognition of special quality. Yeah. In the work and the producer, so it just doesn't go with the ethos. So where is it going to lead us, left hemisphere and the narcissism of today's zeitgeist when we think about art?
The first thing to say is that I can't predict, nobody can really predict. People are fools who think they can. And there must have been points in history when things took a turn that a lot of people at the time would not have foreseen. But I think one of the things is that if we have the time, and that's a big if, but if we have the time, we can make a big change. And I feel there are signs of it happening. So outside of purely thinking about art, I think there's an awakening of people to the limitations of a purely reductionist, materialist way of looking at the world. I think very few young people are really satisfied by this. And since that is, as it were, one of the many messages of my work, I find that that's something that young people particularly respond to. And I think that we can change our values and can reorientate towards the good, the true, and the beautiful. I think when we see what a mess we've made by discarding them, people will be inspired to find new paths to them. And so I am a pessimist because I'm looking at things and they're not going well. But I call myself a hopeful pessimist in that, in a sense, the worse they get, the better they get, because it's only when things get really bad that people are motivated to make things different. And so I think there's a much greater awareness that, as it were, the patient is sick, and to find some healing for that patient. I hope not killing the patient, but that's the way I hope things will go.
But, so you don't think that the patient is in the care of doctors who wouldn't relinquish their control?
Yeah, I don't know. Everything's up for grabs because of the way that everything is changing so fast, partly through technology, of course. And that, I think, is a bit of it's a problem we can't solve because it has its own pace. But before we've really had a chance to see, to consider, to reflect on what the effects would be of making a certain change, it's happened anyway. And the next one is upon us as well. So we're no longer really in a position to control our fate. We have to accept it to an extent. But within that, there can be great inspiring movements. And I see these, that people are moving towards, back towards things that are numinous, speak to us of another realm, that are that go beyond the purely everyday material outlook. And physics, after all, encouraged us in this direction at least 100 years ago or more, to see that it's not just a simple matter of Newtonian mechanics and simple matter, that matter is fields of energy that can manifest in many forms. And that's physics. Very belatedly, biology is beginning to catch up with this in the last 10 or 15 years. There are big changes in the way we now think about living organisms. They can't really be viewed as machines any longer. I mean, they never could really, but it's becoming much more obvious to everybody that this is not feasible anymore. So there are signs that the zeitgeist, the Weltanschauung is changing, and that gives me hope. I don't know a great deal about the visual arts, but I certainly noticed that in music went through a totally ghastly phase between about 1930 and 1960. And then in recent years, some really fine composers have come forth who have ceased to think that you can just ignore harmony, melody, and every part of musical structure and still have powerful music. And it's too obvious. But we were all trained to go, oh, hell yes, of course, maybe, and listen to this random noise and say, yes, very fine. But, I mean, now at least, as it were, the emperor has no clothes and people are saying it. And maybe the same thing will happen in the art world. I'm not up on it, really, but you can tell me whether you feel that there is hope there.
Well, I would say I'm a pessimistic pessimist, just from looking at what is presented and what is discussed. So there are several trends. One is, of course, this content art, which is virtue signaling, ideological, and completely in pursuit of content. Yeah. And fashion, and those change. But again, this is kind of going back to this the Marxist framing of everything. And then the other big discussion, of course, is around art and AI. And that is further complicated by the fact that a lot of AI art, so-called, doesn't come from artists, but it comes from coders. And this is where you would probably look at it and say, well, this is not. So it's missing all of the, implicit, completely, it's literally algorithms. And yeah. I wrote about it, there's this really famous, very hot artist now, Refik Anadol, who had his work placed in the Museum of Modern Art. And the work, very tellingly, was it was based on an algorithm that incorporated the works from the collection. So it was essentially kind of this little kaleidoscope of this, little chars of other art, which didn't amount in the end to an artwork. So it was really quite ridiculous, but that kind of shows you this level of literalness that is allowed under the guise of art. So is that. And then, of course, there's still people who are making so-called conventional art, which could be representational or not representational. And I would almost say that, in abstraction, which has been around for over 100 years, that might be the most promising field because it is a place where the viewer is actually not unlike with representational painting, is not told where to enter the painting and how to look at the painting. So it's very open-ended. And it is often based, abstraction is often based in the concepts of gestalt, and it is often contingent on the physical perception of the color and the form. So there's something, I mean, it's not as you said before, this is not novelty, but you know, it's good because we shouldn't be driven by the idea of innovation as something necessary. But overall, I would say it's not looking good. It's not looking good. And I wanted to ask you, actually, since we mentioned AI, what is your take on AI being used in art?
Well, I don't know much about it, but I think it's important to recognize that one cannot get away from the fact that AI is parasitic on human skills and human understandings and human concepts, although it can't itself understand them. So you can get it to make new things according to, by feeding it a mass of things that human beings have done. I think the algorithmic thing may be quite a separate idea. It's not necessarily based on, I can imagine that it's not based on artworks by humans, but it's instead, if you like, allowing the shapes of mathematics to create forms, which I wouldn't be against that. It's just escaped me. But there is an art form, cymatics, I think it's called, which is the interpretation of sound through vibrations of, if you have a sort of pan of sand and you play music, it starts to make extraordinary patterns, which is really rather beautiful and interesting. And if AI were doing something like that, I would say it had a place. It was probably never going to create great art, but there's a place for minor art as well. But we've got to get beyond that, haven't we? Because, I mean, you're not allowed to say these things anymore, but I'm unabashed. You know, art is one suffering soul speaking something that soul thought important for another suffering soul who comes afterwards. This is the beauty of art, that it is creating relations at the highest possible level that have meaning for human beings. I say suffering because I think it's really important. I mean, not that we spend all our time suffering, although arguably we do, but there's a lot of joy in nightlife as well, one hopes, but it is a very important part of being a human being, and it's not a negligible part or a part that it would be better if we got rid of. I mean, that takes us into a whole other conversation, but it's something that no computer or AI structure can have the slightest idea of. It doesn't have a body, it doesn't have feelings, it doesn't know what the past means, what the future means, it doesn't know what it is to be in love, to all these incredibly important, to have a sense of religious awe and wonder, which I believe are enormously important. It's something that's got stronger during my lifetime. I was brought up in a family that had no interest in religion, whatever. But so I wasn't programmed or prepared or, brainwashed, if you like. I discovered something that is incredibly important, and I don't know, can't tell you exactly what it means. I spent the last substantive chapter of The Matter with Things trying to evoke it in a chapter called The Sense of the Sacred, and a lot of people have responded to it, for my delight. But really all I'm saying is that there's so much more here than a computer can possibly we hope to deal with. And there was somebody, wasn't there, who created a computer that could sort of produce things that sounded like they'd been composed by Bach, and that was entirely because loads and loads and loads of things by Bach were fed into it, and then it took, as it were, kind of pieces or things that it recognized from different bits. And I think what you're getting at, I imagine in part, is that they didn't make a satisfactory whole. So when you heard it, okay, it was in the idiom of Bach, but that wasn't the way that Bach composed. Even his very earliest composition is something staggeringly beautiful and original. So no computer can do that.
Well, not yet for sure, and perhaps I mean that maybe actually the suffering and you know Dostoevsky of course is central to that question. Maybe the suffering is what distinguishes. That's your you know secret sauce for making art. And so speaking of,
I think it does. The greatest filmmaker in the world is your countryman, Andrei Tarkovsky. And not only did he produce wonderful films, but he said wonderful things about them, that art was not to just pass on some sort of coded message, but it was there to harrow our souls in preparation for the afterlife or whatever. So he was a very great, great man. And he was not derivative at all, but he didn't just throw away all the traditions that came before. He brought them to life again in his own work, in a way that will never never die. As far as I'm concerned, there is nobody like Tarkovsky.
You mentioned elsewhere that your next project is about the work by the mentally ill from a hospital where you practiced for decades. And would you please talk about that and explain what is the relationship of this sort of art to the other implicit art?
Yes, I have a plan to write a book based on the art of particularly psychotic subjects, but of psychiatric patients in general. I've worked with them. I'm lucky enough to have some works created by my and other patients. And the Bethlehem Royal Hospital, where I worked, has one of the finest collections of art by psychiatric patients that there is. So what I would like to do, because their work is so interesting and beautiful in its own right, some of it quite disturbing, of course, but it's fascinating. And I think, particularly in the light of hemisphere theory, it helps to explain, it gives another window into what is happening in some of those, in the lives of some of those suffering individuals, yes. So that's what I'd like to do. Mm.
Will you be, I don't know if you can, if you're ready to reveal this, but will you be approaching it in the way that Morgenthaler approached Wolf Lee? That is, as this is an example of art done by the mentally ill, or will it be the Prinzhorn argument about sort of the necessity of expression and all of the traits that have to do with illness?
Well, I think it would be a bit of both, really. But I don't think one can get away from the fact that, you know, the illness is very important to the expression and that you see commonalities. So Wolfli, it was, yes, was a great artist, but his expression was, as all of our expression is molded by our mental world, and his mental world was rather unusual. So what I hope to do is to be able to show people how interesting this art, which is sometimes called outsider art, is. But I want to show people that actually you can feel your way into the inside of it as well and learn from it. So I think it's important because it's a way of approaching an area that's very hard to articulate in language through another medium. So that's what I aim to do.
We're coming to the end, but I wanted to thank you both. It's a truly, truly inspiring conversation, and I hope people will listen and think very, very closely about this. Yeah. So thank you both.
Uh-huh. Well, thank you, Ben.
This is the Athenaeum Review podcast, and you can find out more at athenaeumreview.org.